traditions, plus some, plus Muslim traditions, particularly the Sufis. In fact, Islam came to India first through Sufi missionaries rather than through, the sword, as it were, rather than through conquest. Islam began to spread in India through the Sufi missionaries. And indeed, even today, popular in northern India, there's very little difference between popular devotion to Sufi saints, like in Ajmer and Shishti. I can't remember now.
Muinuddin Chishti.
Yeah, that's right.
And Islamuddin Aulia.
Yes, that's right. But these Sufi saints are also worshipped by Hindus. tradition like the Radha Swami tradition, which fuses Islamic and Sikh, Muslim, Sikh and Hindu traditions. Anyway, sorry, is it a sidetrack? Yeah, he's influenced by Sufism. He's influenced by Unitarianism as well. Unitarians have got a lot of interest in India, and indeed, many famous Hindus came to the West, were hosted by Unitarians, and he's influenced by Deism. Deism is the doctrine of a rational Christianity, if you like, that God is known through reason rather than through revelation. God can be known through reason. Beginning in the end of the 17th century, John Tulland, Martin Tyndale, Herbert of Cherbury, all these people, and indeed John Locke was a deist. So reason, you can know universal religion through reason, and Schleiermacher inherits this deist kind of tradition as well, this deist inheritance. But deism was an influence on Roy. And his aim was to purify Hinduism of superstition, what he regarded as superstition, such as idol worship, doctrine of karma and reincarnation. And he thought you could do this, get rid of these, what he calls superstitious beliefs, through returning to the pure original teachings of Hinduism contained in the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutras. So he adopted wholesale this Western distinction between reason and irrationality, between logos and muthos, between reason and superstition. And he rejected what he thought were the superstitious dimensions of Hinduism. And he wanted this pure Hindu religion, which was based on universal ethical codes and based on the religion of reason, which you found in the early sources of the tradition, such as the Upanishads, particularly the Upanishads and the Brahma Sutra, and in the philosophical commentarial tradition based on that, such as Shankara. Now, part of this rejection of superstition was also the rejection of what he called unethical Hindu practices, such as widow burning, sati, the practice of sati in Bengal. Now, sati, we've done a few tutorials on this. Sati was a practice, it wasn't a common practice, but it did happen, of the widow immolating herself on her husband's funeral pyre. Now, Julia Less has written an interesting article called Sati or Sati, S-A-T-I, long I, or S-U-T-T-E-E, Sati or Sati, in which she presents two different views of this practice. One is the indigenous view, which is that the Sati, Sati means good woman. It's from the root Sat.
So what's the name of the scholar?
Julia Leslie, sorry.
Thank you, sorry.
And she wrote, it's in a book called Roles and Rituals for Hindu Women, Roles and Rituals.
Yeah.
Roles and Rituals of Hindu Women, written about 15 years ago now, I suppose. And in that essay, she presents the two views. One is that Sati, as a good woman, as a person of extremely high esteem and power within the tradition, who becomes deified and brings, from the indigenous point of view, through committing Sati, she goes to heaven and takes her husband with you. I think it says she drags her husband out of hell, takes him to heaven, and brings merit, good karma on the rest of the family. And she herself becomes sanctified and gains power, for sort of 15 minutes of fame, if you like, gains power for that period of time. Now, the other view, the Sati view, for Julia Leslie's account, is that it's misogyny, it's oppression of women, it's murder.
You say, how do you spell the others?
S-A-T-I, with a long I, sati, which is from the root sat, feminine noun from the root sat.
So one with a long I, the other doesn't.
That's right. That's sati is a transliteration of indigenous Bengali and Sanskrit term. Sati is the English version.
So the long
I,
long I means murder?
Oh no, the it just means
long
I to
mean perfect.
It's just a noun, just a feminine noun. To mean a good woman. It's just a transliteration. It means, yeah, good woman, it means.
Mm-hmm.
And sati is the English rendering of it. And she's just making this interesting contrast between these two terms.
Shiva's wife is also called Sati.
Yes, indeed. Shiva's wife is called Sati. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a mythological justification for this. In the myth, Shiva's wife goes to the sacrifice. Shiva's father-in-law, Daksha, is holding a big sacrifice and doesn't invite Shiva to it, if you remember. And Sati goes to it and protests. Sati immolates herself. She bursts into flame from the power of her yoga, from her yogic power, and immolates herself at her father's sacrifice. And when Shiva gets to hear about this, he's so enraged, he goes to the sacrifice and destroys it. And what's left of her body, he dances around, if I remember it correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And the gods chop off parts of her body, or Vishnu does with his discus, chops off parts of her body. Where parts of her body fall, there are famous pilgrimage sites in India. So there's a kind of mythological, that's a medieval myth, mythological sort of justification in a way, or for the origins of Sati. But it was a practice that was not that common, but it did occur, and indeed still occurs. As we were saying in the seminars, I think Judith, you mentioned there was one in 2002, which I didn't know about. But there's a very famous one in.
Yes, sir. That was in my Devra.
Right.
The where I live, yeah.
Oh, was it where you live? Oh, there we are, yeah.
Devra.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
The Sati case, yeah.
Right, yeah. Yeah. And there was another famous one in about 1989, 1988, Rup Kanwa. But anyway, it was made illegal, mainly because of Roy, I think, in 1829. It was made illegal by the British, partly due to Roy's pressure. But it's a practice that has persisted from time to time. And there's other historical precedents, like in Rajasthan, the Rajput princes, when they were defeated by the Muslims. That's right. The women burned themselves with 200 women, in the palace. So there's precedents and historical precedents for this practice. There's an interesting feminist reaction within India against this. So there's a magazine called Manushi, which is an Indian feminist magazine, which is well worth looking at, particularly around that time of the Rup Kanwa case. They were very, very, very articulate about the situation in the village there. And raised the whole question of whether Rup Kanwa did in fact do this voluntarily, or whether she was in fact forced to do this for economic reasons and various other reasons of merit and status for the family.
So we have evidences in history where they were made to consume a lot of opium and then sit on the funeral pyre so that they wouldn't realise by the time they got really burnt.
Yes, that's right. That was common, I think. Giving people lots of opium. So they were, So anyway, it's a practice that's illegal, was made illegal in 1829, but that still persists in some parts of India. And you get sati stones, which are stones with hands on, as icons and focuses of devotion. But certainly the sati is regarded at popular village level as a very highly revered, highly esteemed figure. And certainly the practice of sati brings lots of prestige to the place where it occurs, and the family as well. So there's different views. Now, an ethical relativist would say that a sati is just a different practice, perfectly legitimate within its own tradition, whereas a non-ethical relativist might claim that it's not, like Roy was. Anyway, Roy, he founded the Brahmo Samaj, a society called the Brahmo Samaj, in 1828, and which was like a Christian reform movement. And it had regular meetings, a bit like the Methodists or something like that, and they used to sing hymns. They made the Upanishad, verses from the Upanishads into hymns and used to sing them. And there were two figures that, after his death, that came to prominence. Devendranath Tagore, who was the father of the poet, the famous poet, who you should read, Gitanjali, various other poems, collections of poetry, marvellous poetry, really, and Keshab Chandra Sen. I won't go into, you can read about this. There's a good, quite a good account of these in Glyn Williams' Modern Hinduism. Sources of Modern Hinduism. Now that Brahmo Samaj carried on, and it faded out at the end after Sen's death. Oh, excuse me. I don't know how to turn this off. Hang on, I'll just leave it. I'll stop in a minute. Then there's the Arya Samaj. After the Brahmo Samaj faded away, the Arya Samaj became very important, and it's still in existence in India. And this was founded by Dayananda Sarasvati, who died in 1883. And he was, the story is that he lost faith in Shaivism. He was born into a Shaiva family, and he lost faith in Shaivism because, as the story goes, during Shivaratri, an all-night vigil to Shiva, he was sitting in the shrine, and he saw mice crawling all over, everyone was asleep, but he saw mice crawling all over the icon of Shiva, over the Shiva Linga, and he lost faith in this tradition. How can the pure God allow these impure vermin to crawl all over it? So he rejected traditional Shaivism. He had a guru. He left home, became a world renouncer, and he met a guru. And in due course, he founded the Society to Promote Hindu Reform, which was the Arya Samaj. And his version was similar to Ram Mohan Roy. He advocated return to a pure Vedic religion focused on an eternal, omnipotent, and impersonal God, as in the Upanishads. And he advocated this idea of Sanatana Dharma, Sanatana Dharma, the eternal law. So the Sanatana Dharma is really a construction of the 19th century. You get it, the word occurs in the Bhagavad Gita, I think, but it's only developed in the 19th century. And this links in with this almost deist view that all religions are one, and that truth is eternal, and there's an ethical religion. The true Dharma is a rational, eternal religion that is accessed through reason and is revealed in scripture such as the Upanishads. So with Dayananda Sarasvati, there's a rejection of the epics and Puranas, the secondary revelation of Hinduism. There's a rejection of idol worship, what he calls idol worship, which is arguably the heart of Vedic Hinduism. There's a rejection of the incarnations of God, the idea that Vishnu incarnates into different forms as pure mythologies, purely made up. There's a rejection of pilgrimage. So in fact, all the kind of the main features that keep a religion going, you could argue, Sarasvati rejects as irrational, as going against the purity of the original tradition, the purity of Vedic religion. And he thought, first of all, then there's a rejection of idol worship and a desire to return to pure Vedic religion. And secondly, this desire to return to pure Vedic religion is a desire to construct an Indian nation. So it's very much linked in with nationalism. and that Hindu, a reformed Hinduism, could be a force against Christianity. This is particularly important for Dayananda. Christianity had been successful in making inroads amongst the lower castes and making converts to Christianity amongst the lower castes, and he was concerned about this. Christianity was, it had made hardly any inroads into the Brahmanical tradition. If you read the introduction to One Ear Williams' Sanskrit dictionary, he says he made this to convert the Brahmins to Christianity. There's this great dictionary. He spent his life doing this, but anyway, obviously failed. But the lower castes were, as is inevitable, a people with a lower power, lower power base, if you like, are more susceptible to conversion by a tradition with more power. But when you have a Brahmanical Hindu tradition, which a great depth of learning, a great tradition of learning, that it's very resistant to a bunch of missionaries coming along and saying, join us, especially if the missionaries are more stupid than the people they're trying to convert. Often the case.
Tell me something. If Catholic missionaries on the line of Aquinas, where philosophy and theology are equally balanced, to come along, would that have made a difference?
It probably would have done.
Was the Protestant missionaries who rejected philosophy completely?
Yes, that's a problem. And actually, you did. I mean, certainly the Catholic missionaries in the 17th century and the Portuguese ones were often very sympathetic to the Brahminical traditions, and there's very interesting dialogue. I forgot his name now. De Souza, was it? Very early one. You know, learn Tamil, was in the south, learn Sanskrit, and had a very interesting conversations with the Brahmins. And there's actually a very interesting book by one of my predecessors at Lampeter, Roland Williams, who wrote in the 1830s, I think, in the 1830s wrote a dialogue between a Christian and a Hindu. It's a great thick thing, and it's very interesting. He's very sympathetic to Hinduism. He was the last person to be tried for heresy in England, in the UK, in the 19th century. I can't remember why now, but he was rejected from the church, I think, unfortunately. But anyway, he also lived in Lancashire and Oxford, and he wrote this very interesting book, and in which he was very sympathetic to the doctrines of the Hindus. In fact, the kind of Hinduism he adopted was actually the rejection of the kind of Christianity he wanted to reject, so that's quite interesting. But anyway, so there was a dialogue, and there has been from time to time, but on the whole, the Protestant missionaries tended not to be particularly sympathetic to the Hindu traditions. So anyway, Dayananda thought this was that a reformed Hinduism could be a force against Christianity. And he reinterpreted the caste system in terms of Varna, the four Varnas, the Brahmins, the Kshatriyas, the Vaishyas, and the Shudras. And these are four estates, or four different ways of organizing society. But he rejected the caste system as he experienced it in the 19th century. And he said that you could reconvert Hinduism to Hinduism if you're a low caste convert to Islam or Christianity. And he called this the Shuddhi rite, and that still carries on. The Shuddhi rites are rites to reconvert mass reconversions back into Hinduism from Christianity and Islam. And it's still present, that institution. And the Arya Samaj is very famous for its schools. And it feeds into a nationalist politics. So it was a very early kind of nationalist Hinduism that fed into nationalist politics.
When you said reinterpretation of a caste system,
it was a rejection of the purity and impurity idea that you had.
Rejection of it.
Yeah, that you had in touchables. Yeah, the rejection of untouchability, really. Untouchables sweeping the streets and cleaning loos and all that sort of thing.
And so,
but
rejection of that.
In favour of the ashram, the Varnashrama Dharma, which means the Dharma with regard to your Varna, your four classes, if you like, of Brahmins, warriors, commoners, and traders and serfs, really, the Shudras. But these were not fixed in stone, and these were ways of organizing society, and that people had propensities to different kind of classes, a bit like Gandhi, his reinterpretation.
So there's a different society of this whole structure of society.
Yeah, these were classifications within the whole structure of society, different modes, different ways of organizing society. That everyone has a place, if you like, or in the body politic, everybody has a place to fulfill. And these were traditional ways of looking at that. They go right back to the Veda. And that idea again feeds in later, as we'll see, into Gandhi. So those were the very two important early reformers in the 19th century, Roy and Dayananda Saraswati, the Brahmo Samaj and the Arya Samaj. On a slightly different limb, we have Ramakrishna and Vivekananda. Now, Ramakrishna, again, dies in 1836. All these kind of important 19th century figures in Bengal again. And he was a mystic. He was born into a Vaishnava family. He was married when he was very young because he was a bit eccentric and his family were worried about him. So he married him off to a five-year-old girl, actually, and in the hope that marriage would calm him down. But she wasn't going to... But... It's crazy, because she wouldn't live with him until she was grown up anyway. So, and then he became a priest to Kali at the temple of Dakshineshwar near Calcutta. He left home, left his village, became a priest to Kali. And he was going to trances all the time. He practiced ecstatic devotion to Kali. And he used to have these inner visions of Kali all the time. And he goes into these trance-like states, which were called samadhi in the tradition. From the Yoga Sutras, Samadhi, from Buddhism as well, the same word, absorption, meditative absorption. And he would keep going into these states spontaneously. And there are photographs, there's a very famous photograph, I think it's a stage photograph, it's of him in a state of Samadhi, when his hands would go into the spontaneous mudras, these gestures, and he's standing with his eyes shut, like with his hands up in the air like this. And he would go into these states of Samadhi, and his disciples would rush to kind of stop him falling on the floor and things like that. And there's one story, he says, "Oh, give me a drink of water," and then someone gets him a drink of water, and he says, "Oh, I don't want it." He said, "Well, why did you ask for it?" And he says, "I just wanted to want something." Because when he didn't desire anything, he would go off into a state of samadhi. So desire was the only thing that kept him in the world, so he had to want things to keep in the body. So he would leave his... That was the idea, that he would leave his body in this trance-like state. And he had two important teachers, according to his biographers. One was a tantric woman called Bhairavi, who taught him tantric traditions. And Kali is the tantric... Kali is central to the tantric traditions. So it is quite possible. Whether this is mythology or hagiography, I just don't know. And there was another teacher, an Advaita Vedanta teacher, called Totapuri, a Naga ascetic, Totapuri, who taught him about non-dualism. And so Ramakrishna combines tantric teachings with the Vedanta teachings of non-dualism. And that's an interesting combination. And he is said to have achieved this higher state of samadhi called Nirvikalpa Samadhi, samadhi without any traces left, the highest attainment in the yoga tradition. And Ramakrishna said to have thought that all religions are one, again echoing this Brahmo Samaj idea, that all religions are piles up the same mountain to the one God at the top. And he claimed to have had visions of all deities. How did he know this? He said, "Well, I've had visions of Jesus, I've had visions of Muhammad, I've had visions of the Buddha, and I've achieved the highest goal of all these other religions. I therefore know that by experience that all religions are one, that they're all piles to the same goal. And all religions are different paths to the one." Again, a very important theme in contemporary Hinduism. Kali and Brahman are different aspects of a single reality. Now, this doctrine has great appeal to the intellectual middle classes in India, had great appeal and still does. And there was one disciple, Narendranath Dutta, who became a devotee of Ramakrishna. He became Swami Vivekananda. And he had religious experience with Ramakrishna. Ramakrishna said to have stood on his chest. He was lying on the floor, stood on his chest, and he had this overwhelming religious experience of being at one with the universe. There's an interesting book by Kripal called Kali's Child, who gives a sort of psychoanalytic account of Ramakrishna. A very controversial book, in which he reads Ramakrishna through a sort of Freudian lens of...
Sorry, who was the scholar?
Kripal, Jeffrey Kripal, K-R-I-P-A-L. It's called Kali's Child. And there's a big controversy about it because it's rejected by many Hindus as being sort of insulting, really. There was another one before him called Pal, who wrote, I can't remember the title of the book, but P-A-L, who wrote a Freudian reading of Ramakrishna, arguing that he was a repressed homosexual and that so all his religious experiences were sublimated sexuality, really. Now again, it's... And Kripal follows the same line, a very similar argument. But Kripal is a bit more nuanced in his account. So, yeah, Vivekananda then had this religious experience with Ramakrishna. And he became a renouncer. He started the Ramakrishna mission, and he wandered around India as a world renouncer. He travelled. Traditionally, a renouncer was supposed to go to the four corners of India, circumambulate the continent on a pilgrimage, and Vivekananda did this. And at Cape Corberin, on the tip of India, the island at the tip of India, where there's a Vivekananda temple now, he had a vision of the unity of Hinduism and the unity of God as well.
When was that?
Oh, I don't remember, I'm afraid. You'd have to look it up. And his teachings, he taught that there's a divine in all beings. The divine exists in all living beings. And I'm going to turn this off. It just makes more noise turning it off than it does ignoring it. So.
I've
managed to find it now. So the divine, there's a divine in all beings, and you see the divine in all beings. And if you see the divine in all beings, that will promote love and harmony throughout the world. And he's famous. He came to the World Parliament of Religions in 1893. He was invited there, I think, and he was hosted by the Unitarians again. There was another Mazumdar before him who was, again, hosted by the Unitarians. It was a forerunner of him. And then Vivekananda came along, and he was a great hit, like a pop star of the World Parliament of Religions. All the religions of the world were present at this parliament, except the Anglican Church. The Anglicanism refused to go because it wasn't a religion like these others, you know. So Vivekananda promoted Hinduism as a world religion. He was the first to do so. Hinduism is a world religion. He constructed Hinduism as a world religion. And he argued for the unity of religions, and he argued for tolerance. And he appealed for help in India. He appealed for material support and not ideological support. He wanted, give us material support, give us food, not missionaries. He didn't want missionaries. He advocated the idea of the East as spiritual and the West as material. So what India can contribute to the world is spirituality. What the West can contribute to the world is material prosperity and success. And that distinction between the spiritual East and the material West has been extremely influential in Western perceptions of Hinduism and Western perceptions of India, right up to the present day. So the whole hippie trail to India, the East, spiritual, mystical East, partly responsible for that is our Vivekananda. He founded the Vedanta Society in 1895, and he spent time in Europe as well, and he returned to India and founded the Ramakrishna Mission. And there was a great stress on karma yoga, on action, the yoga of action, doing good works. And so you have hospitals and schools founded by the Ramakrishna Society. And his doctrine is the Neo-Vedanta, a new Vedanta, a new vision of Hindu modernism, in which Hinduism is an ethical, universal religion. It's pluralistic and accepts all religions as aspects of the one truth. And this provided a strong ideology to link in eventually to nationalism. He wasn't particularly nationalistic, Vivekananda, but in a sense of the, say, Sarasvati or the later, some later thinkers, but it nevertheless could feed into that. Now, the Ramakrishna mission in the hierarchy of Hindu ascetic orders is very low down. So at the Kumbh Mela, the big pilgrimage at the confluence of the Ganges at Ahmedabad every 12 years, and there's smaller ones every few years. In the hierarchy of the processions, the Ramakrishna mission are right at the back. And Agyanananda Bharati, who was the German Indologist who became a monk, an Advaita monk, has an interesting account of this in his book, The Yoga Robe, in which he talks to the in which he describes the situation, and the Ramakrishna mission are right at the back because they have hospitals and they're dealing with pollution. They deal with low castes, so the monks are polluted through their contamination with impurity, whereas the higher orders are not involved with that kind of work and so are more ritually pure than the Ramakrishna mission monks, who are low down in the hierarchy. So Bharati's got an interesting account of that in his book. That's still going. The Ramakrishna mission is still thriving. The Vedanta Society is still going on. They've got a great library in Madras at Adyar, in Chennai at Adyar, the Adyar Library, and they still do interesting scholarly work. They produce, they publish, a good publishing house publishes interesting texts, and does interesting, good scholarly work still. But Vivekananda's form of Hinduism has been very influential on the middle classes in India and on Hinduism in the West, particularly this Hindu Western, East is spiritual, West is material. That distinction is very important due to Vivekananda. And then we get to Gandhi. Gandhi, who is the founder of the nation of India, really, was born into a merchant family, Vaishnava again. Devotional bhakti background with Sufi influence. He studied law. He was in correspondence with Tolstoy. He met theosophists, and he read Edwin Arnold's translation of the Bhagavad Gita. And Bhagavad Gita became his favourite book, his most important text, which he carried with him. It's interesting. Gandhi's pacifism contrasted with the martial elements in the Bhagavad Gita and the advocacy of the battle that Arjuna should fight in the war.
So he read English. Translation.
Yeah, he read it in Edwin Arnold's translation.
Not in Indian language.
No, not originally in the Indic language.
He's a Gujarati.
He's Gujarati, yes. I don't know if he knew Sanskrit, he may have done. But his initial introduction to the Gita was through the English translation. And he also, his pacifism, although within his own tradition, Ahimsa was very strong within his own tradition, was also the Jain tradition in Gujarat as well. He was also influenced by Tolstoy in his pacifism, and he had an interesting correspondence with Tolstoy. He practiced law. You've seen the movie, and he practiced law in Bombay, went to South Africa, and returned to India. And an extremely strong character, and with this political philosophy of non-violence and passive resistance to get rid of the British and to realise social change, very effective political mover. And very effective reformer. He had an ashram near Ahmedabad and practiced cottage industries, which is famous for cotton, Khadi, the famous spinning of the cotton. There's salt march against the British, against the salt tax, where they were collecting salt from the beach and got hammered by the British and passively resisted them. And he was at the head of the Indian nationalist struggle. And was a leading voice in the Congress. And anyway, largely, I think, due to Gandhi, there's the British withdrawal in 1947, followed by partition, which Gandhi was dead against, and the creation of Pakistan, and you know the story. But what's significant, perhaps, is that he was assassinated by a member of the Hindu right wing, the RSS, a member of the RSS. Godza was a member of a Hindu organisation, because they didn't like Gandhi's liberal attitude, if you like. So Gandhi's teachings are that God is truth, satya. He very strongly advocated non-violence, ahimsa, which he got from his own tradition and also from Tolstoy. And he advocated satyagraha, holding fast to the truth, and that holding fast to the truth leads to Indian nationhood. The nation of India comes through satyagraha, and satyagraha leads to welfare of all, sarvato daya, the welfare of all beings.
What sort of language is this?
He spoke in Gujarati. He's a Gujarati
so
speaker.
Satya is
But these are Sanskrit terms.
This is Sanskrit.
Yeah. And he advocated brahmacharya, which is celibacy and the control of the self in order to control the population. And as you know the story, he famously was supposed to have slept with beautiful women either side of him and not been aroused by them because of his brahmacharya. And he was advocated reform of the caste system and the eradication of untouchability. The untouchables he called children of God, the Harijans. And he advocated the rejection of untouchability. Now, the Harijans themselves, who call themselves Dalits, the oppressed, rejected Gandhi's attitude towards them. They thought it was too patronising, and indeed the Dalit movement today is very strong, but it rejects kind of the Gandhian patronage. Anyway, Gandhi advocated an ethical Hinduism and the Varnashrama Dharma, the emphasis on Dharma with regard to your stage of life and your class, your Varna. So he was keen on Varna as a way of organising society and as a way of allowing the development of individual propensities and individual inclinations, but he rejected untouchability completely. Now, alongside the Gandhian kind of tradition, you also get a political nationalism developing, particularly the RSS, the Rashtriya
Swayamsevak,
which is a cultural organisation to promote the interests of Hindus against Muslims, Christians, and communists. And they're very influential. They sponsor temples and schools. And although it's sometimes classed as a fundamentalist organisation, it's a bit slightly broader than that. And they do some interesting work in South India. In Kerala, for example, there's an institution called the Tantra Vidya Pidam, which is a place to promote the tantric traditions of Kerala and to teach young kids to be temple priests, and that's funded by the RSS. So it's not completely they're not completely blinkered to pluralism within Hinduism. But it's a cultural organisation. There's another one, the VHP, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, founded in 1964, again a cultural organisation to promote Hindu values. And the political articulation of these Hindu nationalist movements is the BJP, which is developed from a party called the Jana Sangh, which was founded in 1951. And indeed, the BJP were elected into government and then kicked out again about 4 years ago now, was it? Something like that, yeah.
We had a 13-day Prime Minister in Atal Bihari Vajpayee.
That's right, Vajpayee, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
13 days.
13 days, yeah. And they collapsed and they kicked him out and so it goes.
So, but now it's a sort of amazing combination. The Congress is left by the Italian Catholic Sonia Gandhi.
Oh, yes.
She's the daughter of the Gandhi family, and
indeed,
RSS actually projects her as a Catholic from Italy, and she's not. She won the election for Congress, but she was not allowed. The last moment, she had to withdraw from the. It's like the leader of the majority party has to be the Prime Minister.
Indeed.
And she was the leader of the majority party. She gave a thumping majority to the Congress, but because of the RSS the whole nation went on a hunger strike
to prevent
her from becoming the prime minister.
Yes.
So it's become it's terrible at the moment.
Right, right. Well, it's still going on. So you can see the importance of this whole political story. Still very resonant. And then you get local nationalism, like the Shiv Sena movement in Maharashtra, and you've got some terrible communal violence as a result of some of these things. Bal Thackeray, I don't know if he's still alive.
But
he advocated the rejection of all foreigners, all foreign movements from Maharashtra, i.e. Muslims. And you've got some terrible violence of Hindus against Muslims and Muslims against Hindus. And the problem of communalism has been very deep. So, and then in 1992, the famous Babri Mosque near Ayodhya, which was torn down by the Svayam Sevak, the Hindu right, if you like, Hindu fundamentalist movement. And there were strong use of religious themes, and they wanted to build. This was a place in Ayodhya where Rama was supposed to have been born, and they wanted to reclaim it back. So the mosque, which was built in the 16th century, was torn down, but a new temple has not been built, to my knowledge. So anyway, all this is still simmering in India. So you get a rise of political nationalism, which is a more fundamentalist, if you like, Hinduism, and then which contrasts more Gandhian, open, tolerant Hinduism, which is also nationalistic. And you also get Hinduism outside India, the Hindu diaspora. Hindus existed throughout the globe. And you get the pizza effect, which is what Bharati calls the pizza effect. So a pizza was a peasant dish in Sicily, which gets exported from Italy, gets loaded up with pepperoni and all sorts of cheese, and gets re-imported back into Italy as a kind of luxury kind of dish. So you get the pizza effect, cultural pizza effect, if you like. You get India exports bhakti, exports gurus, exports yoga, and they get re-imported back into India as kind of something different. And you get lots of Hindu traditions in the West now. ISKCON, to name a few, Swami Narayan tradition. So Hindu gurus who came to the West, or their disciples came to the West and developed significant followings in the West and indeed in India. So the Hare Krishna movement is a particular example. Swami Narayan tradition, and there are other movements with strong Western followings. This Ramana Maharshi was an Advaitin in South India who taught who am I, the mantra, or the just ask yourself, who am I, and then you realise that you are this one being. If you keep repeating that long enough, you'll realise that your identity with the Absolute Brahman. Yogananda, the Self-Realization Fellowship in California. Sai Baba, who was the guru in South India, he's got various hospitals and so on, but he says he's an incarnation of God, an avatar of God. And he's famous for producing... he's got ash vibhuti from his fingers, and he's got very Afro haircut and very long sleeves, and he produces magical images. Vibhuti Dash, I think it's his dandruff, and then he produces these magical images. And again, he's been in trouble recently for all sorts of scandals, you know, child abuse. So probably a complete charlatan. It's very interesting that he's from a tradition of magicians' caste. His family.
I've seen that Ash thing. And I don't have a logical explanation for it.
No. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen him do that.
You've seen him do that? Really, how interesting. I met an American academic who said... go on.
Got onto a coach and ash started coming out of the person's lap as he walked by.
Oh, really? Good heavens.
I kind of looked, huh?
So...
And the next thing was ash was coming out of his hands.
So it could be the real McCoy.
I thought, now, hang on, as a Christian scholar, I've got to get my head around this and say my prayers.
Yeah,
no. Still don't know an answer to it.
How is well, perhaps he does have these powers. Who knows? But I've met an academic.
It's not unlike what is happening in the Bethel movement in the USA, where as they are ministering, feathers appear in the air and fall down in the front of the church meeting.
How strange!
I think the source of the spiritual production of those two things is very, very different. If I may say so, as a Christian bishop, But I think somewhere in terms of somewhere there is a parallel mechanism as to the how that the world of the supernatural beyond is impinging it into the world of the natural.
It could be that. Even if he does produce Vibhuti and it's a genuine kind of thing, there's also this element of corruption in the in him as well. It's an interesting combination.
Which points to something.
Anyway, others, Radhaswami tradition, Radhaswami satsang in the fusion of Hindu, Sikh traditions, quite a big following in the West. Maharishi, Mahesh Yogi, the Beatles guru, Anand Vital, the Maharishi is a 16-year-old kid in the 60s who became a guru. He was rejected by his mother. Anyway, there's loads of them. Rajneesh, the controversial one, with the Rolls Royces, who started Rajneeshpuram in the States, and they kicked him out.
Osho,
that's right, Osho. Ananda Mai Ma, she's the one that hugs everybody, if I remember. And Siddha Yoga, Muktananda tradition, which is very big in the States again, with who's the guru now? His translator, she became the guru. They charge about £800 for a meditation weekend.
If you're interested, if you wanted to get near Sai Baba, you had to go through all his acolytes, and I do remember one or two people parting with quite a lot of money by the time
that's right.
To get nearer.
And then you get Western Hindu teachers such as he's a very interesting man, Avabhasa Kalki in Fiji. Dar Frijon, you may know his teachings. He says, I am the truth, I am God, if you like, and he's said to be enlightened. There's a Feuerstein book called Divine Madness. There's a book by Georg Feuerstein called Divine Madness, and he writes about Avabhasa Kalki in there, and also Andrew Rawlinson, the Book of Enlightened Masters, has got a good account of Avabhasa Kalki. He's very interesting, and he writes very interesting works, I think, but probably completely balmy, who knows. And then there's other gurus like Lee Lozowick, the pop group, rock group Lee Lozowick, and Jean Klein, the Swiss guru, Kashmiri Shaivism, teaches the truth. Andrew Cohen, another one, Andrew Cohen, started that What is Enlightenment journal. And many other... the other plonkers, really, in my view. So if they charge money or they have sex with their disciples, I'm extremely suspicious of them, and many of them do both. The fact that there are counterfeit coins doesn't mean that there aren't genuine coins. Differences between, you can just read out the differences. In Neo-Hinduism, there's a continuity with the past. The continuity with the past is broken. Ideas are generally from Western philosophers and Christianity. And Hindu traditions read or reinterpret their own traditions in the light of those colonialist Western ideas. Neo-Hinduism connected with cultural and political nationalism, and again, that's a Western concept, nationalism, which has taken on Indian garb. And then the monism of Neo-Hinduism contrasts with the theism of traditional Hinduism. I'm not completely convinced of that, but I think genuinely the village traditions are theistic, and there's a devotion to a personal being, to your Ishta Devata, and they don't have this monistic intellectual ideology which has become dominant in much of Western Hinduism. Although I'd like to counteract that, you've got movements like the Hare Krishna movement and so on, which are strongly theistic and articulate a very strong theism within the Hindu tradition, and much more traditionally based. And the icon is the deity in village traditional Hinduism, as opposed to a symbol for Neo-Hinduism. And there's a Neo-Hindu stress on Hinduism as a spiritual unity, and a stress on inclusivism, which was an idea developed by Paul Hacker. But all that was also an feature of ancient Hinduism. You can read Halfass's account of Hacker in Philology, in his book on philology. I can't remember the title, I'm afraid, but an account of Hacker in that, which is a translation of Hacker. Anyway, thank you, sorry to run over a bit late, but thank you for your attention.